Hello, and welcome to Tolerable Risk, the podcast for NGO, nonprofit, and charity professionals who manage risk. I'm your host, Sabrina Siegel.
Today, we're going to talk to Kate Roberts. Kate is a staff care and well-being specialist and certified master coach supporting organizations and individuals working in the humanitarian and development sector. After almost 20 years of serving in humanitarian responses to conflicts and disasters around the globe, Kate created a consulting firm dedicated to helping aid workers in complex and high-stress environments to address the drivers of burnout, compassion fatigue, and work-related trauma. In addition to her consulting work, she serves as the Global Director of Staff Care at World Vision International. Her background is in humanitarian management, global mental health, and counseling psychology. Kate, thank you so much for coming on Tolerable Risk today. I am excited to talk about moral injury and psychosocial hazards today. They're big terms, big words. People might be a little bit confused by the terminology, but I think that a lot of people who listen to this podcast can probably relate to how these things impact them in the workplace. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Sabrina. It is such a pleasure to join you on your podcast series, and especially to get to talk about these topics. You know, I think that they really have an important place in how we navigate life and work in the third sector. And I'm really delighted to get to expand on that a little bit with you and for your audience.
Great. So for people who aren't familiar with you or your work, can you just tell us a little bit about your background and how did you get into the third sector?
Absolutely. So my background, you know, I've been working in this sector for almost 2 decades, and most of my career was really working in programming, child protection, psychosocial support, and really looking at kind of the programming elements in a lot of really difficult contexts. So disaster responses, active conflict zones. It was really something that I always felt very passionate about, was really excited to be involved in. But after about, I don't know, maybe 8 or 10 years of doing that work and working, you know, contract to contract and different deployments, I started to notice that I was feeling a sense of disconnect from the purpose that I initially entered into the sector with. My disconnection of my purpose, kind of a disillusionment a bit. And I was just feeling exhausted. Just there was a tiredness that I couldn't explain, no matter how many R&R breaks or extended travel, you know, in between contracts. I really was having a hard time to recover from that. In addition to noticing, you know, my cynicism and kind of my dark humor was really elevating quite a bit. And so I really started to kind of grapple with that and really was feeling a sense of shame, a sense of guilt, because for me, I started to feel like I was no longer capable of doing my job, that something was wrong with me, that something was broken, and I was no longer finding that sense of joy. So I kind of took a long break and really tried to understand what I was experiencing. And I know now that what that was the onset of burnout. And really being able to identify what that was helped me to understand what the drivers were of that. And for burnout, it was actually only just recently classified by the WHO a few years ago as this workplace work-related stress phenomenon. And after its classification, it really kind of focused on 3 key elements, the exhaustion, the cynicism, and that disconnect from feeling effective in your work. And the more that I wanted to research that and kind of understand why it was happening to me, I started to look at some really great research by Christina Maslach and her team. And there's some really, you know, just very specific drivers of burnout. And those drivers are all related to the organizational culture, the workplace dynamic, the relationship that you have with your manager or with your team. And what I found really fascinating about that was realizing that it wasn't about me. It wasn't about the individual. It wasn't about me being broken, but it was about how I was engaging with and relating to that workplace dynamic. And so that really took the pressure off of me. And that was really where I became a bit of an advocate for staff care and employee well-being. And the more that I looked into that, especially with the focus on the third sector and humanitarian and development work, really just felt that I wanted to kind of bring that sense of awareness, that education, that understanding into the sector, because we do experience this quite profoundly. And it's quite common, even though it might not be talked about or owned as much, but really wanting to share that with my friends, with my colleagues. And so that's where I started to evolve into kind of a staff care and well-being specialist and opened up an organization to really help individuals be able to navigate healthy life choices, healthy career options, and as well as then consulting with organizations on how to address these psychosocial risks and challenges with employee well-being. And so that's where I came to then start to consulting and really trying to help organizations find their starting point at moving the needle in a meaningful way for their workforce.
Such an interesting background. And I feel like working with things like this, you have that lived experience to go back to. I think that with humanitarian and development workers, people who go into charities and nonprofits are led much more by their heart, maybe than their head, so to speak. And they're willing to push themselves, sometimes even past the point of burnout. And I feel like in the third sector, burnout is such, it's really prevalent. But like you were saying, it's not discussed. And I think, at least in my own experience, it's almost as if it's a badge of honor, right? You know, how far have you pushed yourself to help other people? And I think we have to rebalance that. So I'm really glad we're going to talk about all these things today. So let's get into it. The first question that I'd like to ask my guests is, what is misunderstood about this topic? So if someone is new to the terminology that we're using, moral injury, psychosocial hazards, even burnout, what do people get wrong? What are the mistakes that their brains typically jump to that maybe aren't accurate or are a misunderstanding of this theme in this area?
Oh, such a great question. And I love that this really brings that kind of awareness to the misunderstandings and also to that area of where there's a lot of stigma around this as well, around talking about it. I would say the most misunderstood areas are really the idea that there's something wrong with the individual, that there's something wrong with the person, and that it's really the individual's responsibility to identify the issue and to recover from the issue. So I think that's probably one of the biggest pieces. I think that it's also HR's responsibility, or whatever that HR mechanism, you know, would be called in different organizations, but that it's really only HR that should be kind of mindful of or accountable for being able to develop healthy workplace environments. So I think that misunderstanding with those two elements, in addition to that type of stigma that you were mentioning also, that having this as kind of a badge of honor, that we really push ourselves past the red zone even. And I think that you're very correct in saying that we had kind of really go with our heart. We tend to enter into this line of work, into this sector, with more of an intrinsic sense, that internal sense of motivation that really stems from our identity, our values, our worldview. And those are very formative foundations pieces of who we are. And so when that is challenged, when that is injured, it really creates this internal conflict for us that we really tend to take quite personally, which is where those feelings of guilt, of shame, of fear. And oftentimes, I think what drives us to not kind of talk about this is that fear of being judged, is a fear of feeling like others are going to think that I'm not capable, that others will think that I'm weak, that I might be putting my job in jeopardy, you know, that I might not be eligible for that next career move that I'm looking for. And it was especially true for a lot of people who are on national contracts that might not have the same type of career paths open to them, or if they are in contexts where employment rates are quite challenging, and it creates a sense of competition. And so we want to protect what we have. And I think there's that sense of, if I share what I'm going through, am I going to be putting myself at risk?
I definitely have seen that myself in some of the roles that I've been in. And what you highlight with the challenge that a lot of the national staff sometimes feel, and for those who are listening who may not be familiar with that term, if you're coming from a small charity, usually in larger international response charities, you'll have what's called the international staff, the people who are typically European or American or Australian, fly into a country, run the office, and then you have the local national staff there who are maybe implementing the projects and doing a lot more of the administrative work. And there's a power imbalance there. And I think the third sector has been slowly trying to do a good job addressing that. I've seen some positive moves from some larger organizations lately, but that could absolutely strain the operating environment, the office environment, the relationships within there. But before we go any further, I want to just make sure that people who are listening also understand some of the terminology that we're going to be using today. So can you just give a quick definition or some examples of the term moral injury and also psychosocial hazards? What do those mean?
Absolutely. Great questions. Moral injury. So this is really referring to this idea that, as I mentioned, with that intrinsic sense of motivation that really comes from our values and our identity. And moral injury is really talking about how we might be asked to do things or to behave in a certain way or to present in a certain way that goes against those values and goes against those ethics, where we feel that there's been a violation or there's been a betrayal of these deeply held moral beliefs. So that's really what moral injury is. And it's talking about the psychological impacts of those events. And this can really be seen in a sense of a broken trust, you know, with organizations or especially with managers. And so this is something that we see quite a bit. Psychosocial hazards. So I'll just start with the psychosocial part first. So this is really referring to this relationship between social factors and our thoughts and behaviors. And so that's kind of that psychosocial part. And so really looking at the social impacts as well, and really wanting to then translate this into the workplace. So looking at psychosocial hazards. So when we look at our workplace environments, especially in this sector, we want to look at some of those nuances that really create that psychosocial hazard. It could be anything from the context, the physical environment that we work in. It could be working in extreme heat. It could be a lack of having personal space. It could be working in hazardous conditions, as well as there's social factors that contribute to that as well. Lack of clear leadership, organizational culture, a sense of toxic work environments where there might be bullying or harassment, an individual's sense of work-life balance. And so all of these pieces, it's work design, it's work environment, and social factors that really contribute to these psychosocial hazards.
This is really helpful because I have previous episodes, particularly I had one with a woman named Linda Crockett out of Canada, and she was talking very specifically about bullying and hostile work environment. And so what you're describing around psychosocial hazards and moral injury is a lot broader than that. It's a little bit more all-encompassing. And so it could include bullying like you were talking about, but it could also include the workplace environment. So that's a really helpful thing for everybody to keep in mind as we are talking about this moving forward. So let me ask you this. For small to medium-sized organizations, what are some of the areas that you see are the biggest risk for them? If it's the charity that's down the street working on animal safety, or if it's the charity across town that's working on elder care, when it comes to things like moral injury and psychosocial hazards, what are some of the big risks that these organizations should be looking at?
Great question. For smaller to medium type organizations, I think that oftentimes, depending on where they're at in their development, staff care and well-being might not necessarily be the first thing that they're thinking about when they put together things like business plans or project proposals. And so it's often something that doesn't get considered or embedded or integrated into their overall approach. So for smaller organizations, I do feel that there is a risk of just not prioritizing it, not creating time, not creating budget lines for it. You know, that's a very practical approach. But talking with client organizations, a lot of times I will hear people say that, gosh, this is a priority for us. This is a priority area for this. And I will often come back to them and say, okay, well, if it's a priority for you, tell me how you are spending your time and your budget, right? Because these are two of our most valuable resources. And if people are not able to demonstrate how they're investing time and resources into it, then it kind of begs the question, is it really a priority? And in this day and age, especially in this phase of COVID, I think there's been so much, I guess, visibility and kind of amplifying of this call for staff care, for employee well-being, and but not just the sector, it's really been the global workforce. And we've seen that demonstrated or illustrated in a lot of the documents, the research that has been coming out from places like Gallup, McKinsey, Deloitte, that have really identified the impact that this can have on a workforce and the future potential of organizations if they fail to take this into consideration. And I would also say, depending on the location, and some of this might be geographical specific, there is also a new trend with the up and coming workforce, Gen Z. There's a very different expectation that this group of individuals is coming into the workforce with, and their expectations for staff care, for employee well-being, for attention to some of these pieces, that's a greater expectation. And so I think that there's also a risk there of falling out of relevance for the workforce and for smaller organizations that want to be able to attract top talent and to retain top talent. So I think that that's also a really big risk for all sizes of organizations to be aware of.
You mentioned budget, and because a lot of the folks who listen to Tolerable Risk are low to no resource organizations, can you talk a little bit about what are some good staff care types of things that organizations can do with minimal resources or free, right? Or maybe just time. And then maybe what are some things that they can do if they set aside a small budget? What are some really impactful things that an organization can do to support this work?
Oh my gosh, this is wonderful. I can answer that in one word, and it's listen. Listen to your workforce. Create space. Create a welcome space, a safe space for your workforce to feed back and to let you know what are your pain points? Where are the struggles? How is it being felt? How is it being experienced at a very individual level? And really have a sense of curiosity. Ask the questions. Help me understand why. How do you feel this? How do you perceive these actions or this communication from leadership? Genuinely listening to your workforce, I think speaks volumes. And then, of course, and then there's follow-up steps to that, creating an action plan and then exploring the barriers. You know, why are some of these challenges present? And really be willing to dive deep and to be vulnerable. We don't mean to name it or shame individuals or organizations or leaders, but it's really about creating this openness and a vulnerability to say, hey, let's pause. And how can we do this better? Let's build an organizational culture, whether it's small or medium or large, that really reflects what is most important to our workforce. Because if we are not moving the needle on the pieces that matter the most to our workforce, then what's the point that we're going to be getting it wrong? So going back to listen, really just listen. And that's just a free thing. That's a very low cost. It's very low risk. It can be facilitated by external consultants or individuals to create that safe space. But yeah, definitely listening. And then I think I would go back to psychological safety is really investing. Again, this is no cost, but it is time. You know, there is a cost in time and being willing to ask ourselves the hard questions, especially people managers, especially leaders. And you really need to have that buy-in from your top level executives and making that case for why this is important. Why is it worthy of our time? Creating psychological safety and building that trust and that transparency. And you can see how that then plays out in individual performance and being able to achieve the team objectives and goals. So again, these are really low cost, low risk options. And then for kind of a next level, I would really encourage organizations to have intentional conversations with donors or however their funding mechanisms, you know, might be established, but having those kind of conversations and say, this is really important to us. And we really want to start increasing budget for it. We want to start tackling some of the other drivers, like for financial well-being, especially today in this environment where cost of living has had a serious impact on people and their stress mm-hmm. levels, their idea of how they see their future progress. So in having those conversations with donors or with sponsors, and also getting a sense of where there is openness to partner and to collaborate with donors. I've always been an advocate. This has been for years, even prior to COVID, really advocating for line items. You know, just putting in a line item on a budget, on a project proposal, even if it's a very small amount, but just giving staff care or employee well-being its own line item, it helps to elevate. It helps to elevate the awareness both to donors and it demonstrates the prioritization to the workforce. And of course, it increases the resources that are available to really invest in additional mechanisms that can really support well-being.
Those are really great answers. And I want to get back to the donor budget question because you started talking about that and that's what was going through my head. But before we go there, I want to go back to the advice about listening. And I'm going to very gently play the devil's advocate here. A lot of times you have organizations who do staff pulse surveys and have listening hours and their leadership says we have an open door policy. And let's say even best case scenario, there's psychological safety. People feel comfortable speaking up, right? But then there's never any follow through. And then people get tired of saying, well, yeah, okay, yeah, we can speak up, but no one ever does anything. So listening, yes, I think listening is important. And then also there has to be some accountability once those things are said. I worked at an organization once, and once I tell you the story, you can guess what the operating environment was like. Where basically the senior leadership, the CEO said, well, I don't really want to have a complaints mechanism because it's going to call attention to our compliance. And then what are we going to do when all these things start coming in, right? I mean, at least that person said the unspoken part, but when an organization is listening, they also have to act. So what are some of those things that they can do to act and really have that trust with their staff if their staff feel comfortable enough to speak up?
Oh, so good. Look, I would, even before engaging in listening, I think an initial step would really be for leaders, for managers, for organizations to kind of step up and say, hey, again, going back to this idea of taking a pause and say, you know what, we hear that you're hurting. We hear that there are challenges and we are willing to acknowledge that we might be getting it wrong. And some of the things that might be in place right now might actually be causing harm. And so I would really recommend that leaders have an internal conversation first within their teams and their management structures to say, okay, what are we willing to put out there from ourselves, from our messaging to indicate that this is different, like it's different this time. And starting by acknowledging where we might be getting it wrong is a really important piece of that. And we talk a lot about psychological safety. And I really challenge our leaders and our managers to say, hey, what might I be doing? What are my behaviors? What are my thoughts or my actions that might be contributing positively to our team dynamic or our work culture, to psychological safety, but also what might I be doing that might be hurting my team, that might be contributing negatively to psychological safety? It really starts with being vulnerable and open and honest with ourselves first, and then as a leadership team and being able to share that. Because if we expect the workforce to trust us, right, to trust us as leaders, that we should also be willing to trust our workforce and to be willing to go there with them, to be vulnerable with them, that we need to demonstrate that, to model it, if we can have any expectation of our workforce giving us their time. Their time is also valuable. We are asking them to do some pretty outrageous things with their tasks and responsibilities. And so their time is also valuable. So we want to communicate that we value their time, we value their input. And so that's really first and foremost, to communicate that this has the potential to be different. And then in an action plan, following up, being willing to be held accountable and say, hey, okay, we have heard you. We have heard that some of these things that are in place might be hurting our workforce, and we are committed to seeing change. And I would really recommend that organizations, again, of any size, put these into two buckets that we could identify some quick wins, right? Some of those short-term strategies that we can put in place quickly that will help to alleviate some of the stress, some of the concern. And that can even be communication, right? I think one of the biggest pain points that I hear about is lack of communication or lack of open or transparent communication and how much that really does to demonstrate trust and communicates trust to the individuals. So they definitely focus on that bucket. And then also a bucket that is really dedicated to that longer term strategy. Some of what we hear about or the major drivers are things like workload or things like financial stress and financial well-being. Those are never going to be quick solves. They're never going to be easy or quick, but being committed to following through with them and recognizing that, okay, we're going to put together a 2-year plan or a 3-year plan to make sure that this remains a priority, that we are going to do our research, to do our homework, and to bring people, the decision makers, you know, that can really help us to move the lever where it matters most.
I really love your points about being open to accountability. Leadership and management have got to understand that at points in time, it might sound personal, but it's not. But having that openness to accountability and not thinking that everything you do is perfect is really going to be key. And then also that communication, right? Making sure that people understand where you are in that improvement journey, like you were talking about. What is the immediate plan? What is the 1-year plan? What is the 2-year plan? And feeding that back to them so that they can see, this is what we've done. This is what you asked for. This is what we haven't done yet. And here's why. Or this is what you asked for, and this is what we just can't do, and here's why. And just acknowledging it instead of hiding it or ignoring it or forgetting about it. So I really love those two elements that you just described, Kate. The other thing I wanted to go back to, though, was donor budgets. And this kind of takes me to my next question as well. You were talking about line items, and I'm with you 100% on line items for staff care. At the same time, I have seen those budgets come back redlined, and the first things that are redlined are the staff care items, right? You send a proposed budget to a donor and they go, yeah, we love your project. Take out this one, and this one, because we're not going to fund it. And it's typically staff care, staff ongoing training, things like that. So if we're going to make a business case for this, and the second part of this question, which relates is, you know, if somebody is listening today and they're going, you know what, my organization, we really do need to start focusing on staff care. We need to focus on addressing these things like moral injury, burnout, psychosocial hazards. If somebody's listening today and they want to make a business case, either for their senior management and leadership or for a donor to keep these line items in a budget, how do they make this business case? What are some really powerful and impactful points that people can make in order to get the money, the time, the resources they need to make sure that this risk is addressed?
Great question. Conversations around finances, around budget, around conversations with donors. It can feel daunting as well, especially when, as you mentioned, we know that there's going to be pushback. So often we get those communications of, hey, this one has to go. I would really advocate for organizations to really push back, especially when you're doing a project proposal and there are clearly staff positions that are tied to a project, especially if we're talking about really complex or dangerous, hazardous work environments. That's really where they can push back and say, hey, these are the environments that we are asking our staff to go into and the dangers that they are going to be exposed to. We have a responsibility, especially for this type of project, to be mindful of that, to be mindful of the risks that they are facing, the fact that the sacrifices that they might have to be making. Now, I know that that's very different for kind of longer term contract positions, because there is that responsibility that the organization itself is being responsible for the funding of those pieces. But when it's tied to projects and staff are tied to projects, this is where I would really recommend pushing back. And I have seen, even in my own examples, working with donors, where we have seen that type of an approach to really be beneficial. Looking at the type of research that has come out, there's a really interesting one, and I'm going to misrepresent it or misquote it. I just don't remember who it's from. It was from Deloitte or McKinsey. Anyways, there's a statistic that says, and it's really based on the research, that there's 5-to-1 return on investment for investing in staff care and employee well-being. And it touches the bottom line, right? It touches the bottom line of budgets, because as we were talking about risks, and the implications that not being attentive to this is looking at high staff turnover, increased absenteeism, reduced work performance, and a lack of engagement at work. All of these things are costing money. And this is really where, if we are get more on that proactive and preventative foot, we're really making more of an impact and kind of getting that return on investment. This is something that I really love to kind of talk about, is this investment on both sides. We tend to think of staff care and employee well-being as really being this more response-based, where we're responding to the needs, where we're responding to the crisis or the stress or the trauma. But what I really want to challenge organizations to consider, and there's a great quote to illustrate what I'm trying to say here. I think it was by Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and he says something along the lines of, we need to get to a point where we stop just fishing people out of the river, but where we look upstream and ask, why are they falling in? And this, looking at how do we become more proactive and preventative and building the case for those types of functions. And so these are the kinds of conversations that are probably a little bit slower to take effect with donors. But that's really where we want to work to build that case for them. So do your homework, do your research, push back where you can, and really continue to raise awareness. And I do think that in general, my experience with donors, there has definitely been a slow but steady uptake of the information and realizing that this investment has a direct impact on bottom line, as well as in project deliverables.
That's a great answer. And I think that's going to be a really powerful data point for folks to make this business case. Again, like we're saying, both to donors and their own senior leadership, as to why this is no longer fluffy or nice to have, but this is really something that is part of just doing business these days, and we really have to take seriously into consideration. Along with senior leadership, organizations also have boards. They have trustees, boards, members of different boards, advisory boards, organizational boards. But a lot of time in the third sector, these board members and trustees are volunteers. They believe in the mission of the organization. Their heart is in the right place. But, you know, maybe they've never been on a board before, and maybe they're really nervous about doing the work that they need to do. Maybe they don't want to embarrass themselves. Certainly, they don't want to harm the organization that they are now responsible for. So if you are advising new board members, or even board members that have just been in role for a couple of years, if they're listening today and they go, yeah, you know what, I really want to make sure that my organization is taking staff care seriously, we are addressing things like psychosocial hazards, what kind of advice would you give to board members and trustees? Are there questions they can ask? Is there data that they can request? Can they ask certain people to come and speak to them directly? How can they demonstrate their support for this?
Just as I answered the previous question with just the one word of listen, similarly on this side, I would really ask questions about the well-being of the staff and the organization that you're supporting. Ask questions about how has work-life balance changed for your workforce since COVID? Let some of these narratives come up and really challenge the leaders as well. Hold them accountable and say, we really care about you. We care about how you're leading the organization. but we also care about how the workforce feels and how they're experiencing that sense of value from the organization. Let us know what are their biggest challenges so that we as a board can help to set strategic priorities or to help set some of those action plans. And so really asking the questions. You can request information data on things like turnover rates, on sick leave, and start to see if there is a correlation between people leaving organizations. But is it voluntary or is it more by separation? Voluntary separation as an indicator that people are unsatisfied, you know, either with the work, with the management, or with something within that organization that they have chosen to leave and pursue their career elsewhere. Those are really significant indicators. And I know that things like exit interviews tend to capture information, but also part of that data doesn't get utilized or doesn't get really implemented. And so that's also what I would really recommend board members to request, seeing just that the health of the workforce.
Those are great questions. And I can't stress enough the importance that board members have. And if you're listening and you are a new board member, you really do need to feel empowered to ask, just like what Kate said. Ask a lot of questions. There are no stupid questions. And if something is not sitting right with you, just ask some more and get that data. Someone said, trust but verify, right? And so for board members, that's just so, so, so important. So on to the next question here. Kate, you were saying how burnout was recently officially categorized by the World Health Organization. And so this area that you work in is changing a lot. It's pretty dynamic. And it seems like the conversations around burnout, the conversations around bullying, the conversations around diversity, equity, and inclusion, discrimination, things like that are, at least from what I've seen, really heating up. And in a good way, people are talking more about it. We see more hashtags about it. We see more conferences and discussions. So how do you stay on top of the changing terminology and thinking and findings in this environment? And for people who want to learn more about what we've been talking about today, what could you recommend for continuing education? Keeping in mind low to no resources, so maybe going back to school and getting a master's isn't an option, but are there other online learning platforms, blogs, websites, podcasts that they can listen to learn more about this area?
Yeah, great question. Yeah, this is certainly an area of focus that it's not new. I mean, especially if we're talking about burnout and we look back at the research, it's been going on for decades. Really, there's probably about 40 or 50 years of research that's been going into burnout, but it really has just been in the past few years. I think it was 2018 or 2019 where WHO and the ICD classified burnout. And so it's kind of given it this new elevation. And I think being aware of some of the developments that are coming out of this space, and part of that is going back to, again, to listening, to being able to identify who are key players and who sets the tone, who is really investing. And oftentimes it's maybe mental health specialists and actors in the sector. So part of what I try to challenge myself with and kind of monitoring trends and staying on top of things is listening, asking the questions, and also trying to engage in contributing to research. We love being able to partner with other organizations that are really trying to explore the drivers behind burnout, behind overload. So really to contribute to conversation. Networking with others, I think, is really valuable in helping to cross-pollinate ideas, to be able to challenge ourselves, to challenge our own thinking on this. What I do on LinkedIn in just following a lot of thought leaders that I find very valuable, people like Brené Brown, like Amy Edmondson, Simon Sinek. I mean, those are great. Adam Grant is another one. Granted, most of these are quite Western thought leaders, but there's a lot that really helps me to challenge my way of thinking and to not just be complacent with status quo, but also recognizing that this is an area that, again, has recently gotten more amplification. And I would say that it's kind of a buzzword. It's kind of a buzz concept, especially in this sector. And we know that trends, they come and they go. And part of my work, I try to be very aware of that. I get to engage in this work in a very privileged time where there is such a call for well-being. So I don't feel like I have as much of a fight as I used to. But I'm also very aware that that might change, you know, and I don't know how long it's going to last. But while I have it, I am going to grab all of the resources, all of the attention that I can, so that when my flavor of the month is out of style, out of fashion, that I still have a significant pot of resources to be able to fall back on. So being very proactive on that, recognizing that we don't know how long we'll be able to ride this wave. Hopefully it's not a trend. Hopefully this is really just a way of life and a way of work. Networking, being familiar with different concepts, different ways to communicate it. And again, going back to listening, just ask questions, ask people, not just organizations, but really get to individual level and understand, how individuals experience their workplace very differently, right? So, Sabrina, what might work well for me might not work well for you. A really positive and great and wonderful workplace for me might be something that could possibly be toxic for you. And so really being willing to kind of look at that from a very individual level, I think also kind of keeps me a bit sharp and really trying to modify what we do so that it's very accessible. It becomes more accessible, more relatable, and very contextualized.
I love the flavor of the month thing. I can't wait until risk is the flavor of the month, but I'm not sure if people like salty and bitter, which is what people associate with risk a lot. But I absolutely hear you. And coming back to risk, Kate, one of the things I've really enjoyed about chatting with you today is risk is not just a list of horrible things that might happen, right? Risk is a coin with two sides. It is threats and opportunities. And a lot of times with the topic that we're talking about today, psychosocial hazards, moral injury, things like that, people look at the threats, which is important. We need to make sure that we don't have hostile work environments. We need to make sure we don't have bullies. We need to make sure that people feel accepted and involved. But I really like how you have also talked a lot today about the opportunities that we have in this area, building trust, listening, right? Having sustainable approaches to this. So when you're not the flavor of the month anymore, you still have this embedded in the ways of working. And so it's really been wonderful chatting with you and weaving this topic into risk because it is threats, but it's also opportunities. So this has been wonderful. Before we close, anything we didn't cover? Any parting words of wisdom for small to medium-sized, low to no resource organizations talking about psychosocial hazards, moral injury, and risk?
Oh, absolutely. As much as I really do try to push the responsibility and kind of the onus on leaders, on managers, on executives and organizations, I also want to say we all have a part to play. We all have a part to play in this. And as the questions that I posed in regards to psychological safety, it was really to be willing to ask ourselves also in a very individual, very personal conversation with ourselves. What am I doing that can be contributing really positively to this psychological sense of well-being? But what might I be doing that might just be perceived wrong, even with the best of intentions that we have, to be willing to say, hey, maybe, you know, my communication on this last project, or maybe this decision that I made might have just not been received well and might have potentially caused harm. Where can I be intentional about owning that also? So a lot of my messaging on social media, on our website, really does challenge the leaders, but also recognizing we all have a part to play in that. So that's what I would leave you with.
Absolutely. I think asking yourself those questions and maybe even asking other people that you trust, it's really helpful to identify those blind spots. And so whether you're doing risk management for a project or whether you're trying to build a positive working environment, identifying those blind spots is definitely a key to it as well. So thank you so much for your time today, Kate. Where can people find you? If people are listening today and they go, wow, this was a really interesting conversation. I learned a lot. I have some questions. How can people get in touch?
Oh, great. I think probably two places. One is a website, which you can find me at www.katerobertsconsulting.com. And the other place is LinkedIn, of course. And you can just type that in as well and find me. You can drop me a message. I'd love to engage with your audience and answer any follow-up questions, give advice. So do please feel free to reach out. And it has been an absolute pleasure talking with you, Sabrina. Thank you so much for this platform and giving an opportunity to raise awareness, to kind of create some education and also normalize these conversations that are so important and really valuable in kind of, again, moving the needle.
Absolutely. I think that more conversation in the risk space has to be had around what some people might consider sort of soft risks, but really have the potential to derail an organization and all the good work that they do. So I'm really happy to have you on today. I have learned so much. Thank you for your time today, Kate. It's been great.
A pleasure, Sabrina. Thanks so much.
So that's our show for today. Please remember to like, subscribe, and follow us for all your third sector risk information. Thanks for listening to Tolerable Risk.